Progressive Voice of Minnesota. You're on FYI Politics Wednesday edition of the show. I am riding solo today, hosting the show and also producing. So for the most part, that means probably will not have a lot of time to take your phone calls. You can try during those commercial breaks and we can hopefully get you on the airwaves. Otherwise, your next best chance is going to be during our 3 o'clock hour when Gregory Rich is going to be filling in for Matt McNeil, as we're going to continue our theme of solutions, coming up to all sorts of solutions to the world's political problems. So that'll be during the 3 o'clock hour. Greg and I had a lot of fun with that yesterday and looking forward to chatting with you about that today as well, coming up during the 3 o'clock hour. But for now, you are on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, and we have lots of news to get to today from the state legislature and also the Attorney General's office. So joining us now to help us sort through what's been happening at the Capitol of Minnesota is our Capitol reporter, Kevin Featherly of Min Lawyer, who joins us now. Hey, Kevin, how are you doing today?
Hey, so you're having to play drums and lead guitar at the same time today.
Huh? I am a man of many, many talents, Kevin. that's at least what I like to tell myself. Well, you, of course, are a man of many talents, too. You were telling me you were working, what, like 90 or 100-hour weeks the past few weeks over at the Capitol?
Somewhere in the range, somewhere between 80 and 100. I'm afraid to actually do the calculation. I might pass out.
Well, hopefully you've been able to recover and at least get some sleep this week. And I'm sure you'll be right back at it when they have their next session coming up in a couple weeks.
Yeah. I'm hoping that one will be sort of the traditional one day, let's get it over with, and that they'll have agreements in place beforehand. That's something they didn't do this time.
Yeah, we'll have to see once that does come up in the next few weeks. We will be talking about what happened in the state legislature last week, but first I want to get to this major announcement we had out of the Attorney General's office, as AG Keith Ellison has announced that he is suing ExxonMobil Corporation, the American Petroleum Institute, and three Koch industry entities for perpetuating fraud against Minnesotans having to do with climate change. So, Kevin, this is a significant lawsuit that's being filed by Attorney General Ellison, something that, as I read through this, looks to be almost as maybe even more significant than the tobacco lawsuit we had back in the 90s.
There are a lot of parallels, and sort of the theory of the case is similar. I think what they're essentially saying is that, you know, they're over the years, the petroleum industry, both through sort of a public information arm, which is the American Petroleum Institute, and through the companies themselves, have been engaging in advertising, engaging in messaging, continually sending out confusing, deceptive, fraudulent messages to the public to sort of convince them that either the use of petroleum based fuels is safe or not as dangerous as is being claimed, that there's a lot of distortion on the other side. It's basically sort of the same idea that it's deceptive marketing in effect.
So what specific statutes are the Ellison Attorney General's office alleging they violated? I mean, it sounds like they're going along the lines that they lied about climate change. I know they cited a couple of documents that I think Exxon put out like in 1979, clearly admitting that climate change was a thing due to fossil fuel consumption. Is that largely along the lines of why they're suing, saying that essentially these big petroleum companies lied to Minnesotans?
That's effectively it. This is under the civil statutes. I thought you were going to try to ask me which particular sections. There's a bunch of them listed. I could give you some codes, but I don't think they'd make any sense to your audience. Yeah. But I think effectively what you're saying is correct. This is really about consumer fraud. And the reason this is being filed in state court as opposed to federal court is that Minnesota has some of the strongest consumer protection laws on the books in America.
And, of course, Minnesota is not the only state engaging in this type of lawsuit. I think there's like 14 or 15 others. So Yeah, Minnesota, not the only one doing those. So certainly, yeah, the petroleum industry and the big gas industry are certainly going to be seeing more of these types of lawsuits, it seems, in the future. Can you talk about what sorts of damages Attorney General Ellison is looking from this lawsuit?
Well, he says he wants them to disgorge their profits, their ill-gotten gains. And what he wants to do with that money is fund a corrective, what he calls a corrective public education campaign related to climate change. And that would have to be administered by some independent third party. So really, you know, he's looking to reclaim the profits that, you know, if this suit is successful, the judge or the court will find their sort of ill-begotten gains.
So let's
don't know how much that would amount to. I don't
right.
think the minutes. They do say that these three companies earned hundreds of billions in profits while Minnesota shouldered the costs of, you know, climate change.
And going back to some of the parallels we were drawing between what's happening with this lawsuit against the big oil industry companies, including ExxonMobil and others, there are a lot of parallels to what we saw back in the 90s when the attorney general at the time, correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, I think it was Skip Humphrey, who
yes.
was able to successfully sue many members of the tobacco lobby, many companies that were involved in the tobacco lobby, and that led to quite a financial windfall for the state of Minnesota. But as we were talking a little bit off the air before we came on, you were talking about how the strategy that was used back in the 90s by Skip Humphrey's office was talking about how the effects of tobacco were harming children, and in this case, it might be a little bit tougher for Keith Ellison's office to make those same types of arguments that, well, climate change is specifically hurting children.
Yeah, I mean, I asked that question. That seemed to be the decisive factor in the tobacco suits, that when the information, the research that had been done internally that suggested that you need to hook kids early before they really had the capacity to make informed decisions was key to the marketing strategy. Well, here, you know, you've got adults buying petroleum to fuel their automobiles. And we've, you know, Al Gore made his movie, 2005. We've been aware of climate change for a good long time. And, you know, I asked Attorney General Ellison, what strategies do you expect to have to combat here? What will be the arguments that you'll be facing? And it kind of boiled down to, well, we weren't lying, but if we were, you knew it and you should have known better.
So this is more of a logistical question, but what court is this lawsuit being filed in? Is this something that's going to go immediately to the Minnesota Supreme Court, or is this something that's probably going to get tied up in litigation for years?
Oh, I'm guessing years. It's being filed in Ramsey County District Court, so it's starting at the state level. And again, that's because Attorney General Ellison felt that it was best to use Minnesota's laws because Minnesota's consumer protection laws are very strong.
Okay, so yeah, it'll start in that district court. And of course, whatever decision is made is likely going to be appealed. And this ultimately will go to the Supreme Court is kind of what you're guessing, right?
Well, maybe. I that's hard to know. I mean, the court would have to accept it, and you never know what the Supreme Court's going to do. But I would, you know, yeah, I would think it would get at least to our Supreme Court and then probably beyond.
Yeah, that makes sense. That kind of strikes me. That would at least be my best guess. But I'm no lawyer. And as you said, of course, the courts need to accept the cases in the first place for them to obviously even be heard. Any other major highlights you want to point out from the press conference that we may have missed?
Just one thing that I thought was really fascinating, that there was a document that's republished in the middle of the lawsuit. If you're following along, it's on page 16. It shows that in 1954, the California Institute of Technology submitted research proposal to one of the litigants here, the American Petroleum Institute, which existed way, way back then. And they show that there was research already in 1954 that industrialization was causing problems. And it says that since 1840, the ratio has clearly increased markedly, meaning the ratio of carbon in the atmosphere. And in this 1954 report showing that the levels of carbon have already been rising at that point for 114 years. Says the effect can be explained on the basis of changing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere resulting from industrialization. That was in 1954. That's pretty much the same thing Al Gore said in 2005, and it's what we're saying today.
Wow, that's unreal. Yeah, you're talking well over, well, gosh, well over 60 years ago when, yeah, that was put out there. So that sounds like a pretty strong argument that, yeah, Ellison could be making once this does end up in the court system. 1954, wow.
One other quick tidbit fact on it is that it, according to this lawsuit, 50% of the carbon released to the atmosphere in world history has been released, if I read this correctly, since 1988.
Ooh, yeah, that's another really interesting stat. So, yeah, it's going to be – we'll have to follow along this. This does work its way through the court system, and as we were talking about, this will probably be tied up for a number of years. But once a decision is ultimately made, whether it's for or against the state of Minnesota in this lawsuit, it's going to have some major, major impacts and probably have, if the state of Minnesota wins and Attorney General Keith Ellison, probably would be the same type of groundbreaking lawsuit we had back in the 90s with the tobacco lobby.
And a last footnote, there was a guy, Doug Blanke, who was a member of the of Skip Humphrey's team on the tobacco suit back in the 90s, who spoke at the press conference today and said that he thinks that this lawsuit stands on very firm ground.
Yeah, so this could have a major, major impact, yeah, on the big oil industry. A few other topics I want to touch on you with, Kevin, and of course we want to talk about what happened last week in the state legislature. So you and I were talking about how a number of Republican state senators in Minnesota are pushing for a Department of Justice practice and pattern investigation. Can you talk a little bit about what these practice and pattern investigations are? It's not a term I'm quite familiar with, but it sounds like we had something similar to this happen in Ferguson back in 2014.
Yeah, I mean, it's really pretty simple. A practice or pattern case involves investigating allegations of systemic police misconduct. It's pretty much as simple as that. And usually they wind up with some kind of comprehensive agreement, you know, designed to support effective policing, restoring trust, that kind of thing. That can come in the form of, you know, a declaration by the court that imposing certain orders, but basically that's what a pattern or practice case is. And what was confusing, and I cleared it up, I think it's important, maybe your readers, or excuse me, your listeners might be wondering, well, isn't the U.S. attorney already doing an investigation? Indeed, she said she is. She is part of the DOJ. She's the U.S. attorney. Erica McDonald is already conducting an investigation. And I asked Keith Ellison about that today. Hers is a different kind of investigation known as a color of law investigation. And what that's about is willfully depriving or conspiring to deprive somebody of their rights under color of law. In other words, using your position as an arm instrument or, you know, of the law to deprive somebody of their rights. So that's kind of different. It's not the same thing. So what these guys are calling for is a different idea. It is much more in line with what happened at Ferguson.
And it sounded like there was some resistance from Democratic politicians to this type of investigation, being that they think it's really not the most effective type of investigation, especially given, well, with what's in the Department of Justice right now.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Ellison told me today he'd welcome this. He thinks that a genuine pattern and practice investigation by the DOJ would be great. But the problem by his lights is that the Trump administration has been pulling out of all of these kinds of cases. And he mentioned that the attorney general in Illinois had to pick up one of these kinds of investigations when the DOJ dropped off. And that was regarding, you know, the pattern or practice of abuse in the Chicago Police Department. So he's saying it'd be great, but, you know, this Department of Justice has a president who, you know, as Allison pointed out, instructed cops not to worry about securing the head of the defendant as he's trying to get into a car. So he's not quite sure that this Department of Justice necessarily has the interests that the community might want protected at heart.
We're speaking with Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter for Minn Lawyer, M-I-N-N Lawyer. You can also follow him on Twitter at Kevin Featherly. Of course, you were at the Capitol for the past few weeks covering the special session, and I have to imagine, I of course wasn't there myself, but this seemed like it was one of the most contentious sessions we've had in quite some time, as there were certainly lots of disagreements between Republicans and Democrats on how to deal with this issue of police reform. Was that kind of your observation too?
Yes, but I'd go a little bit even beyond that. Certainly there were those disagreements on the specific policy, but what I saw, particularly in the Senate, was the emergence of a real ideological divide by race. And that's kind of new. particularly new in the Senate, which is, you know, the cooling saucer, the sedate body. But the real dramatic debate over race, and that happened to be over these police reforms, they're kind of, they're sort of mixed together, at least in the way the debates played out. It was pretty stunning to hear Republican senators lament that it appeared that the Senate is broken, to hear the speech that Senator Hayden gave on the floor, which was very dramatic. I mean, I think if you'll let me do this, I'd like to just read a short passage of the speech he gave, because it sort of really gives a flavor. These are words that I don't think have ever been heard on the floor of Minnesota Senate. He said, "I'm tired, sick and tired of asking people every day if you have law enforcement community that's supposed to protect me, that they don't have, that they don't put a boot on my neck, that they don't choke me, that they don't humiliate me, that they don't stop me for no reason, that they don't ask me, what am I doing here? Why am I driving that car? I'm tired of having my heart race every time a law enforcement person gets behind me, because I've been socialized to be afraid of them." That was on the floor of the Senate. Those are words that I think anybody, I mean, they were delivered in sort of the sedate Senate way, because decorum is so important. So if you were just listening, not necessarily absorbing what was being said, you may not have noticed what was going on. But that kind of rhetoric on the Senate floor was, to me, nothing short of stunning.
Yeah, it is something you don't often hear on the Senate floor, and it does go to this larger issue that we were kind of alluding to, and that's the idea that there is a big difference between the Republicans and the DFLers in terms of how they see race with what's been happening with the police, where to me it seems more like, and especially this is true, I think, on the Republican side in the Senate, that they're seeing racism as more of a sidebar issue. Is that kind of how you were picking up things too? Or they weren't quite?
Yes, that was actually in response to a question I asked, because of the way the debate played out at the press conference yesterday. I wanted to know, okay, because they had been talking about wanting to protect the civil rights of the citizens of Minneapolis. They were saying, these three senators, Dave Senjum, Bill Ingebrigtsen, and forgive me, who was the other guy up there? Scott Newman. Three senators, all from outstate, all white guys. They were all making the case that the civil rights of the citizens of Minneapolis need to be protected. And to do that, they needed not only to have a pattern and practice investigation of the police department, they also wanted accountability of the decision making at the level of the city. And so they're having this discussion, and I asked them, reflecting back on the way the debate had gone on the Senate floor, where members of color were saying, "Why aren't you asking us what we want? Why aren't you engaging us in the debate? Why aren't you asking our input on these bills? We're the ones affected by police violence. Our constituents are the ones whose business is burned." Reflecting on that, I asked, "Well, did you ask any of these members of color for their input on your proposal to bring the DOJ in? Who did you talk to, and why aren't they here?" They didn't answer that question, but what Bill Ingebrigtsen did sort of steer around to was that racism is kind of a sidebar issue. Hmm. And I don't really know what he meant by that, but what I sort of intuit, and this might be wrong, but they're not really, by their lights, maybe racism is kind of a sidebar issue, because what they're really trying to highlight here is how screwy Minneapolis's leadership has been. And I think this is largely positioning for the election. And so for them, they want to show how bad Democratic leadership has been in Minneapolis, in the city of Minneapolis, how it leads to chaos and mayhem. And if that's the case, then perhaps by their lights, in that context, racism is something of a sidebar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just goes to the politics of the issue, where it is, yeah, easier for them, at least electorally, to say, well, this is just a Minneapolis issue with the problem of the leadership, not necessarily something for the state legislature to deal with, where, yeah, it does really kind of deflect the conversation away from racism and does highlight, well, instead, what's happening in Minneapolis, which is, well, unfortunately, sometimes the reality of politics, where you try to distract from the issue. And that sounds kind of like the case of what we were seeing at the state legislature. That's at least me editorializing that right there.
It, true, but it's also pretty close to what they enunciated. They did say this was about Minneapolis, and that came up on the floor many times. For instance, in the idea of banning warrior-style training, Senator Ingebrigtsen, he's a former sheriff, said that he's not seen – he thinks that warrior-style training, if done correctly, is defensive. It's not offensive. And he said that he's not seen that as a problem in his area of the state. He wonders if that's just a sort of a facet of the way Minneapolis has been run. Enunciating that point.
Mm-hmm. What were your kind of views on the GOP's proposals for police reform? I remember Governor Walz made the comment that he did kind of backtrack from an original statement he was talking about and saying that, well, the GOP isn't negotiating in good faith. He kind of backtracked that and thought, well, they are negotiating in good faith, but just overall their policies don't go anywhere near far enough, and that's why, for the most part, Democrats didn't support them. What were your kind of thoughts on what the GOP was proposing? I mean, it did seem like they are making at least some progress in terms of trying to propose some sort of police reforms. But as you saw, yeah, Democrats weren't on board for the most part of any of their ideas, not thinking they went far enough.
Well, I kind of think it went the other way around, because I think that the Republicans really weren't on board with most of the Democratic ideas. In fact, the Republicans offered just five bills. They were not objectionable to the Democrats largely, although there were some shifts in policy and in the approach to policy that I think Democrats objected to. For instance, an important part of this whole thing had to do with changing what's known as the use of force doctrine. That is the law. It's in the criminal code, and it describes the circumstances under which police officers can use deadly force. And the statute sort of says if they have, you know, reasonable fear for their life, basically, they can go ahead. And what the Democrats wanted to do was insert into that part of statute, into the criminal code, language that says that before they open fire, they have to just pause for that moment to consider the sanctity of human life. How effective that would be, I don't know. Commissioner Harrington says it's been done in New Jersey. It has been effective. But what the Republicans did, they did adopt the language, the exact same language, but instead of putting it in the criminal code, they were putting it in an administrative part of statute, which basically just tells the post board, the Peace Officer Standard and Training Board, to order police departments to go back and rewrite their own use of force policies. And, you know, the way John Lesch described it to me is you either have a law that's enforceable or not, or you have a policy that's enforceable or not. And the distinction is vast. So instead of having that language in the criminal code where somebody could actually be prosecuted, they have it in policy where, you know, to some degree there's latitude.
Mm-hmm. I remember having another interview with one of our Supreme Court experts a few weeks back, and he was talking about, yeah, you can put in these types of policies, but really the question is, are they enforceable? Because a lot of times the courts don't even enforce these types of things, whether they're bans on chokeholds or whatnot. So, yeah, as you're saying right there, the enforcement part is a big factor in this, because you can put in policies and ban chokeholds or ban warrior-style training or ban whatever else. But, yeah, if they're not enforced, not going to do a whole lot of good.
Well, and chokeholds is another area of agreement that sort of morphed into an area of disagreement. They both agreed on the principle. But as I understand it, the Senate had sort of an escape valve, which, you know, to some degree might be reasonable if you think about it. That is that if a chokehold is the last instrument available to protect the life of the officer or of the bystander, then it can be used. But Jeff Hayden on the floor said he called that the great loophole, and they wanted an outright ban. So disagreement or agreement became disagreement on that thing. And that's the kind of thing we saw play out even amongst those few pieces of legislation that the Republicans submitted.
So as we get ready for another special session in a few weeks, which I believe we are going to have, what are your thoughts on what we could see for a continuation of the debate on police reform? Do you think we could end up seeing some sort of agreement in the next session, or for the most part are both sides pretty locked in and trying to make this more of an election issue, at least more on the Republican side? What are your thoughts on that?
It's a little like trying to predict what the Supreme Court's going to rule.
Yeah.
I mean, what I hope, very selfishly, because I don't want to put in that kind of week again in 3 weeks' time, but I'm hoping that they do what they normally do with special sessions, which is arrange in advance and come to agreements and then just go and vote on those things and keep it bright and tight, you know. I don't know if they'll do that. I think the governor might want to take that approach. I think he sort of suggested that's the approach that he's going to prefer to take this time. That, you know, I think he sort of suggested in a press conference that he kind of learned his lesson here, that, you know, we're not just going to have another one of these open-ended things if he can avoid it. But of course, he doesn't have much power over that. All he says is, you know, he's the guy with the starting gun. He fires it. They're off and they're racing, but he has no way to stop it once it's started. I hope they have agreements in place that would make this work much better. I think, you know, cynically, and it's possible that they've solidified positions that they think they can take to the electorate on both sides of this issue. And so I don't know if you'll get much agreement, you know, maybe along the lines of the five things that, you know, there really was substantial agreement on that the Republicans, you know, that it's limited, but, you know, it's not nothing. And maybe they settle on those things that would still preserve, I think, in large measure, the electoral issues that they could still take to the polls, if that's indeed where their thinking is.
Yeah, we'll have to see over the next few weeks. And you brought up that important point that normally special sessions are pretty much set in stone ahead of time what's going to be debated. It's much different from, well, a normal session where you do have more open-ended items that are discussed. Where, yeah, as you brought up, in a special session, those are usually dedicated to just a select few topics. So this was a pretty unusual special session that we had.
Yeah, I mean, we had one that wasn't dedicated to just a few topics last year, where they basically made all of the budgetary decisions in a special session setting. But they did that very quickly. You know, they did it in a marathon overnight session, but they got through all of their budgets after failing to get through them in the regular session. But they did do it that way, and they got it done quickly. It's not the way to do it. They've got the whole session to get this stuff done, and that seems to be the pattern. You know, we get clearly with the COVID-19, the Capitol was closed down for a good long month, and they were going to Zoom hearings, and they, you know, lobbyists weren't able to go, reporters weren't able to go. You know, there were a lot of things that were limitations this time out. Nonetheless, there was time, and they didn't spend the time getting the work done on time, and that is a, you know, unified theme over the last decade, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm at least hoping for you that we get a much quicker session in a few weeks so you can at least get some sanity back and not have to work upwards of 100 weeks or 100 hours a week. I don't think you want to
bless
work 100.
Bless your heart, my friend. Bless your heart. I hope you get a drummer to sit in with you so you don't have to do all the work over there, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, not only for your sake of getting the session done quicker, but I think for really everyone's sake that we can see at least something get done in the legislature.
Yeah, we're making light of the situation, but it should not be forgotten what has happened in Minneapolis and that there are people hurting. And I mean, you know, there was a bill to get about $300 million in aid to rebuild the damaged portions of the cities along University and Lake Street and Broadway, and that didn't get done either. There is important work that needs to be done.
Yeah, and that does sum it up on a serious note. Yeah, there is a lot of important stuff that needs to get done, just unfortunately not the case as of yet at the Capitol. Hey, Kevin, we are unfortunately up against the clock right now, but do appreciate you going a little bit long with me today. That's Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter for Min Lawyer. You can also follow him on Twitter at Kevin Featherly. Hey, Kevin, thanks again for the time today.
Thank you.
Hey, we'll have to check in with you in a few weeks. We're going to take a break and come on back with more on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
Howdy, Matt McNeil here, and I love Rudy Luther, and not just because of my love of the Toyota Sienna. I keep going back because of Luther's top-notch customer service. A great example of that is the Luther Advantage Card. With every new and used vehicle purchase, you'll get 3 years of 10 cents off per gallon of gas at Holiday Station stores and $5 off the Works car washes. The Luther Advantage Card keeps you happy in your Rudy Luther vehicle, which in turn makes me and many others very loyal Rudy Luther customers. Find out more at Rudy Luther Toyota, 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
Hi, Gregory Rich, owner of Habitation Furnishing and Design and host of Drink in the Style, Saturdays at 7 and Sundays at 5. You know, we're all sitting at home right now, and chances are you've noticed a thing or two that you wish you could change. Well, the Habitation Design staff is here to help. Right now, we're offering free virtual interior design services. It works like this. You guys are home? We're all at home. Let's schedule a virtual walkthrough of your space. Using FaceTime, Zoom, or Skype, one of our degreed professional interior designers will take a look, tell you precisely how to measure your room, then provide you with specific product recommendations, a design plan, and everything you need to make your space beautiful and functional. So we've all got the time. Why don't we take advantage of it? Call Habitation at 952-426-3548. That's 952-426-3548 and schedule your virtual design appointment today.
If you have a painting project, you should consider hiring Nick Slavic Painting and Restoration Company. We've been awarded nationally for craftsmanship, are highly professional, responsive, and fairly priced. If you feel overwhelmed by starting a painting project, we make it easy from start to finish. We move furniture, vacuum, sweep, dust, and put your home back the way we found it. There is a difference. Our professionalism sets us apart. Visit NICKSLAVIK.com. That's NickSlavik.com to learn more.
Hi, this is Chad from AM950. Whether it's storm damage from the past or a new issue that's popped up over the years, Snap Construction is the company we trust for all roofing, siding, windows, and exterior construction needs. Snap Construction is arguably the most well-reviewed roofing, siding, and window company in the metro. Ryan has worked with many of our listeners and is excited to help more.
Thank you to all the listeners we have worked with and all the listeners at AM950 that we haven't had the opportunity to work with yet. This is Ryan, owner of Snap Construction. Safety of our homeowners and our team at Snap Construction has always been the utmost priority. We are still offering free, no-contact estimates. This summer at Snap Construction, we've rolled out a new referral program. Mention AM950 and we'll make a donation to the station in your name. Together, we can all work to ensure AM950 continues to thrive and grow in our communities. Call for your free estimate today. 612-333-SNAP. 612-333-SNAP.
Hi, I'm Peter Solak.
And I'm Adam Ostrowski.
We are here at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces to talk about the joy of live fire cooking. Cooking over a live fire is the oldest and most basic form of cooking.
What's new is in the way a fire is handled and its heat is managed.
It's easier to experience and enjoy the smell and taste of food cooked over a live fire.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces sells and installs live fire grills, fire pits, and ovens. Let us help you experience the smell, the taste, the fun of cooking with fire.
Pizza was first made and is still best made in an open fire oven. The radiant and conductive heat of a live fire is unmatched for wood roasting and baking artisan breads too.
Come see the many ways you can cook over a live fire.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces strives to maintain a healthy environment for their customers and employees. They invite you to visit weekdays 9:30 to 5:30 and Saturdays 9:30 to 4. You'll find an uncrowded and comfortable social space to learn about Woodland Stoves' many indoor and outdoor fireplace products. More at woodlandstoves.com.
With your AM950 weather, I'm Brett Johnson. Look for partly sunny skies today with a high near 78. Tonight, clear with a low around 60. Thursday, sunny with a high near 87. And Friday, rain with a high around 84. And with bars and restaurants set to reopen for both indoor and outdoor seating, make sure you consider our Eat Local Minnesota restaurants for the next time you go out. All of those restaurants are locally owned and operated, and they have a wide variety of food and drinks you can choose from. Find a full list of all of those restaurants at eatlocalminnesota.com. We're back on AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota FYI politics with Brett Johnson. A reminder, coming up at 3 o'clock, Gregory Rich going to be filling in for Matt McNeil as we're going to be having another solutions show as we are going to solve all of the world's political problems with solutions. Yes, we can do that in 1 hour. So look forward to that. Gregory Rich filling in during the 3 o'clock hour. I'll be joining Greg as well on that show. Then 5 o'clock, don't forget, Pilot's Progressive Party, as Robert and Wendy Pilot are going to be talking much more about that big announcement by Attorney General Keith Ellison filing that lawsuit against ExxonMobil, Koch Industries, and American Petroleum regarding climate change, a major, major lawsuit. And we'll have more on that coming up during Pilot's Progressive Party, as Robert and Wendy are going to be speaking with Sam Grant of MN350. But want to shift to some national news now and something that's kind of been flying under the radar in regards to the Trump administration. And that's the fact that over the next few years, he is going to be owing a ton of money with debt that he owes to a number of banks, something that's really not been covered a whole lot in the news recently. So joining us to talk about that is Russ Choma. He is a reporter in the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones, covering money in politics and influence. You can follow him on Twitter at Russ Choma. Choma is spelled C-H-O-M-A, as he joins us now on the show. Hey, Russ, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, definitely. So we often hear about all the conflicts of interest that Donald Trump has, whether it's, citing some of the examples, investments in the Dakota Access Pipeline, floating using his Doral Resort as a G7 site, having foreign leaders stay at hotels. But one area that really has not gotten a lot of attention are all of these loans that Donald Trump has coming due in the next few years. So, Russ, can you kind of talk about the scope of what's coming due for him? Because the total amount is, close to a half? What is it, like $500 million, something around there?
$500 million. Yeah, that's right. So when Donald Trump came to office, he had a number of loans, deals that he did before he even ran for president. He financed a bunch of his projects. These are big commercial loans. They're usually a 10-year loan. It's pretty normal. So he has a number of these that he signed in 2012 or 2014. And 10 years is 2022, 2024. So a theoretical second term for him. And some of these loans are pretty big. You know, the Trump organization always tries to downplay this by saying, well, you know, he's not that in debt. And so, for example, on Trump Tower, which they estimate is worth about $450 million, he only has a $100 million loan. So they say it's only a quarter leverage. It's not that big of a deal, which, you know, I guess it's true in commercial real estate. But $100 million is still a lot of money, and it's an interest-only loan, and it's due in 2022. And so he's going to owe $100 million. And he either has to pay his lender $100 million, or he has to find someone to refinance the loan. In the world of commercial real estate, this kind of stuff isn't that unusual. He would probably very easily find someone to refinance it. He's done it before on a lot of his properties. You just keep turning over the loans over and over. You pay the interest, and then when it comes time to sell the property, you pay it off. But he's not just a real estate developer. He's the president. And anytime the president borrows money, there's questions. And I think that this is one of the most the sharpest, most pointed conflicts of interest. You know, it's more money than just about anything else. And I mean, as anyone who's ever borrowed money knows, you know, the people who lend you the money have a lot of leverage over you. So I think it's a big deal. And I think it's a real concern. If he's still in office, how is he going to pay this money, or how is he going to get it refinanced?
And as you wrote about over at motherjones.com, the one part that really has me concerned is that you say on some of these loans, they're guaranteed by Donald Trump himself,
which means he
is personally liable, where in theory banks could go after his personal loss or personal assets. And that's a big problem if you're the president of the United States, if you have banks that in theory could seize your personal assets.
Right. I mean, the conflict of interest actually sort of cuts two ways. There is a saying of J.P. Getty, I think it was, that, you know, if you owe the bank $100, it's your problem. If you owe the bank $1 million, it's the bank's problem. And I think that some of his lenders do have this. You know, some of his big loans are due to Deutsche Bank, which is this big, huge German bank, has lots and lots of trouble with regulators. As the American president, he has a lot of power over them. He owes them money on his Doral golf course, $125 million. What are they going to do to him? Are they going to come? I mean, there's a personal guarantee, but are they going to come and take his personal property? Are they going to come to the president of the United States and try and take something from him? I mean, we've seen how he reacts to companies that don't like his policies. You know, he's openly tweeted and said from the presidential podium that he's going to get companies that he doesn't like, you know, CNN and AT&T. It sort of puts Deutsche Bank in a spot. But also, you know, if Deutsche Bank wanted to, yes, they could come and take his stuff, which would set up a huge, huge crisis, I think.
Well, and the other alternative they could do, and I would find this much more likely, is that they could go to Donald Trump and say, oh, all right, well, you owe us all of this money. We could technically go seize your personal assets. But instead, why don't you put in some policies that might be a little bit more friendly to us? And obviously, they wouldn't be as direct as that. It would be a whole lot more subtle. But that is a possibility of happening.
I mean, either way, you know, what you have a situation is a mixing of public business with his personal business. And that's a problem, because if anyone, you know, it makes us doubt who he's really representing. You know, if he makes a decision either to the benefit of the bankers or to punish the bankers, and it's not for the best interest of the American people, that's huge. That's a huge, huge problem. And I think the other thing here is that he could pay these off, but I don't think he has the money to do it. You know, he doesn't have that kind of cash laying around, which creates a particularly awkward situation.
So let's talk about this company called Ladder Capital. This is a bank that I had not really heard much about, but basically they lend to wealthy people as a last resort is kind of the crux of what I got. Can you tell us a little bit more about them?
I mean, they're not actually a bank. You know, it's a Wall Street firm. And what they do is they lend you money. So if you can't get money from a bank, you go to them. And, you know, I mean, they're not totally fringe, but they're not as stable and they don't offer as good a rate as a bank. So, but you go to them and they offer you the money, they lend you the money, but then they turn around and they securitize it. So they package it into a bond and then they sell it off on the stock market. So they've actually passed on the debt. Like they don't actually control it. Now that creates sort of an awkward situation because we don't really know who at the end of the day, you know, someone who's bought up some of the debt somewhere on Wall Street is going to have an awfully big say in how that money gets collected, you know, and if he can't repay it, he'll have to work out terms on how to repay it. And we don't really know who that's going to be with. It's not like a normal bank where you can sort of predict what's going to happen. And the thing is that if he can't get refinanced with them, or if he can't get refinanced with Deutsche Bank, he's got to go down the line to the next set of people willing to lend you money, because there are people that places like Ladder are not willing to lend money to. And then you get into sort of a strange world of sort of Wild West. You know, you've got hedge funds, you've got wealthy people, you've got foreign banks, all these sorts of things. And at that point, you really start asking, what do these people want? Getting into a business relationship with the U.S. president, in particular Donald Trump, is a risky thing to do, you know, given his track record. So what kind of person is willing to lend him money when he's in the Oval Office? And I think that's the question we have to ask.
And it's easy to look at this from 10,000 feet and say, all right, well, most rich people do end up taking out some sort of loans. But as we're talking about here, these are really unusual loans that he's been taking out, including, I think you were talking about, a $100 million interest-only mortgage on Trump Tower and another $13 million loan against Trump Plaza. These were both taken, from Ladder, we were talking about just a second ago. And the idea of taking out an interest-only loan is really unusual because, as I kind of read into it, the principal kind of be damned on that when it comes to paying back those loans.
I mean, that was one thing that sort of shocked me, because I think for the average person, I mean, this is an important point. But I mean, this is not something that most Americans have any sort of context for. I mean, most of us, if we borrow money, we think we have to pay it back, and we plan to pay it back. We want to pay it back. And from what I understand, I mean, it's not terribly unusual in the commercial real estate world. But he's not just in the commercial real estate world. He's in the presidency. So it's a totally different sort of ball game, and it raises totally different questions. And one of the things we talk about a lot is the things that are acceptable for a New York City real estate developer to do are not necessarily acceptable for the U.S. president to do. And this is all created because he refused to divest from his business interests when he took office. You know, because his name is on these loans, because a lot of these loans are personally guaranteed by him. You know, he could have avoided all this, and he didn't. And now, so here we are. And I think that this is really, there have been a lot of conflicts of interest over the years, but I think this is really set up to be the biggest one yet.
So what would Deutsche Bank or Ladder Capital do if Trump does get reelected and he's in office until January of 2025 as these loans come due? Do they extend them and maybe put less than ideal terms in for Donald Trump, or do they try to find a way to actually get him to pay these things back? How do you see this playing back if he's still in office and these things are coming due?
So I think Ladder is a little bit different because they are this sort of like Wall Street driven thing. I mean, they're really driven by the numbers. And if the numbers don't add up for refinancing, they just say, no, sorry, yeah, numbers don't add up. Deutsche is in a little bit different position. I mean, like they're a struggling bank, you know, they're not, and they've really been battered by their association with Trump. They've had a lot of problems, they've gotten a lot of scrutiny. They've gotten subpoenas. They've gotten, you know, all this sort of, it's not been good for their reputation. So, you know, some people I talked to said in the commercial banking world said, well, you know, they should just extend it, give them an extension, a year or two extension, just to get it out of the way. But that raises like a fundamental problem, because everyone else who banks with them doesn't get that. I mean, I don't get that if I need, you know, help repaying a loan. And it's fundamentally unfair, and it's unfair. And it raises questions like, what else is going on here? You know, because it's clearly not just a financial transaction.
And final question for you here, Russ, why do these banks even loan to him in the first place, given his history? I mean, why are Deutsche and Ladder Capital still loaning to this guy, given his history?
So like I said, you know, Ladder is the sort of number driven thing, and he didn't get very good interest rate from them. So I mean, like they lent him money and he had to pay more for it. And then they securitized it. So they got rid of a lot of the risk themselves. Deutsche, that's a fantastic question. You know, he's borrowed all of his money from Deutsche from their private bank, which is a special unit of the bank that caters to high net worth individuals. But the commercial side of the bank that usually does loans like this, said they're not going to deal business anymore because he sued them when, you know, he had a big loan in a Chicago tower and he defaulted on it. And then he sued the bank and said it was their fault. And it was this whole big fuss. And so the commercial bank said, we're never lending to him again. But then their private bank stepped in. I mean, it's one of many mysteries out there. But I think that they would not lend to him now. They've said that they won't lend to him now, but they did lend to him. And now they've got this date of destiny approaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just an entire mess if he is reelected because he's in office, and we were kind of alluding to it. It's tough if you're sitting there as a bank or a lending company like Ladder Capital and you're trying to collect that money against the president of the United States. Right. That's a president
who's shown himself to be vengeful. Mm-hmm. And not afraid to use the power of his office to take out that vengeance.
Yeah, most definitely. Hey, we've been speaking with Russ Choma. He is a reporter in the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones, covering money and politics and influence, as we're talking about all these loans that are set to come due during the next few years of Donald Trump, whether he's in office or out of office. You can follow Russ's work over at motherjones.com or on Twitter at Russ Choma, RussChoma. Hey, Russ, thanks so much for the time today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good chatting with you. We'll take a break. Come on back with our final segment of FYI Politics.
In the Army National Guard, family means everything.
Our parents, they were really supportive that all five of us would join. I got my education because of the Guard. I got to travel a little bit and experience a whole different culture. It helped me get my job, helped me pay for my house.
Serving part-time in the Army National Guard instills pride that you and your family will share. Visit NationalGuard.com to learn more about part-time service. Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard. Aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
We've been spending more time in our homes the last few months than ever. Have you looked at your floors? Are they just dirty? Or is it time to replace your flooring? Well, lucky for you, nobody knows carpet and flooring more than the experts at Zero Res. Z Floors by Zero Res partnered with Shaw and Mohawk to offer custom solutions to fit any lifestyle and budget. Whether you're considering carpet, hardwood, luxury, vinyl, or tile, Z Floors by Zero Res will bring their mobile showroom to you for a safe, free in-home consultation. Call 952-ZERO-RES or visit ZeroResMinnesota.com.
Hi, this is Laura. These are indeed confusing times. So much of our life, education, business, meetings have moved online, yet not everyone has internet access. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, is here for everyone. Radio reaches people without internet. In fact, radio reaches more Americans than any other platform. 92% of U.S. adults listen to radio every week. Radio connects. If you know some organization, maybe a religious or civic group, seeking to engage and knows that a Zoom call costs money and does not reach everyone, consider a taped or live broadcast on AM 950. Perhaps a virtual not-so-silent auction, recovery support, spiritual support, business networking, poetry slam. If you want to learn more about creating a live or taped message on AM 950, call 952-946-8885 or email Laura at am950radio.com. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, here for everyone.
Hi, this is Ken Hagland, host of Living Healthy and Aging Well, inviting you to listen to our new show airing on Saturdays from noon to 1, where we talk about your health and your life and provide insights to living and aging well. Each week, we provide answers to important questions regarding health care, elder care, end-of-life care, and caregiver support to help you and your loved ones plan for the future and enjoy your highest quality of life today. Please join us every Saturday from noon to 1 for Living Healthy and Aging Well.
Hi, everybody out there at AM 950 Radio Land. This is Paul Metza inviting you to listen to a great new episode on the Wall of Power Radio Hour Weekend. We're featuring Bob Dylan's new record, his 39th. Some are considering it a masterpiece called Rough and Rowdy Ways. We play several tracks, and we talk with great liberal blogger, columnist for Esquire.com, Mr. Charlie Pierce, about it. Charlie's a big Dylan fan like I am. We have a lot of fun and listen to some music. This Saturday at 6 p.m. on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
I'm Nick Slavik, proprietor of the Nick Slavik Painting and Restoration Company. I've been a craftsman for 25 years. You'll not find someone who loves their job more than me. The process of painting your home could not be easier. Go to nickslavik.com, click on the button Paint My Walls or Paint My Cabinets. I'll personally be in contact with you to get an estimate, either in-home or a free virtual estimate. We move furniture, vacuum, sweep, dust, and put your home back the way we found it. We're not like other contractors.
Hey, I guess we found a new name for our show.
Really? What's the new name?
Pilots Progressive Party.
How did you ever come up with that?
Pilots our name and progressive fun is our game.
Well, what's that about?
It's a one-hour news show with progressive guests and information you normally don't hear on the radio.
Well, that's so exciting. I have a few ideas for guests myself.
I know they'll be progressive.
Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. on AM 950.
The Progressive Voice of Minnesota.
Final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Coming up at 3, Gregory Rich going to be filling in for Matt McNeil. I'll also be helping out Gregory during that show. Another solutions type of program coming up where we are going to solve all of the world's political problems in just 1 hour. Feel free to call in during that 3 o'clock hour at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We welcome your solutions to any political problem. Then at 5 o'clock, Pilots Progressive Party. Don't miss that, as Robert and Wendy Pilot are going to be joined by Sam Grant of MN350, as they're going to be talking about today's announcement from Attorney General Keith Ellison about his lawsuit against ExxonMobil, Koch Industries, and American Petroleum in regards to climate change. That could be a landmark lawsuit similar to what we saw in the 1990s when the state of Minnesota sued many companies that were in the tobacco lobby. Just a few more thoughts before we head into that 3 o'clock hour. So you've probably seen in the news what happened in Wisconsin last night with statues being toppled and people being assaulted. But something, as I was watching what was happening, just didn't sit with me right. So the first one I want to talk about is this Wisconsin State Senator Tim Carpenter, who was assaulted when he tried taking videos of the protesters. It was just really weird because these two women, white women, I should point out, immediately ran up to him and tackled him with no context whatsoever. And then in regards to one of the statues that was toppled, it was called the Hans Christian Hegg statue. Now, if you don't know about this guy, Hans Christian, he was an anti-slavery activist and leader of an anti-slave catcher militia in Wisconsin who fought for the Union during the Civil War. So just the fact that that statue was toppled, just something doesn't sit right with me right there. I don't know if this was an inside job type of thing with agent provocateurs, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case, just given the arrests we've seen in Minnesota of different agent provocateurs who were arrested in regards to what happened with the looting and the riots the past few weeks. So would not be surprised if all is not what it seems with what happened in Wisconsin last night. That's all the time I got. We got Gregory Rich up next.